Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the critically acclaimed Streaming Club, the only club where we review movies? No, that can't be right. Wait a minute.
You really need to think this out before you start recording.
No, it's more fun this way. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. And this is the Streaming Club, not on Disney Plus, because these ones are on Disney Plus.
Yeah, if you're a patron, and we're very grateful to you if you are, thank you so much. None of these shows would exist without you. But over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, we have a monthly show called Not on Disney Plus, where we talk about movies that Disney produced, but are mysteriously not available on their streaming service, even though, for the most part, by all rights, they should be. And what we have discovered is sometimes Disney doesn't know what they have, and there are wonderful movies out there that would be totally awesome and deserve a bigger audience. And sometimes Disney knows exactly what they have, and they are ashamed of it and don't want it on there. And we discovered one of those this month. We reviewed a film called One of Our Dinosaurs is Missing, starring two-time Academy Award winner Helen Hayes, starring two-time Academy Award winner Peter Ustinov, and it is racist and gross.
It's super-duper racist.
We're not here for that today.
No.
But what's worth noting is that not everything that is on Disney Plus is necessarily something Disney was always very proud of. Disney has made, you know, Disney's been making movies since the 30s, they've made a lot of hits. They've made a lot of movies that weren't hits but did okay. And they've made some major flops. And a lot of the flops are on Disney Plus. Sometimes they've been reclaimed by time and now they have a lot of fans. Tron became like a cult sensation after the fact.
They even made a sequel. They're talking about doing yet another sequel to Tron.
I'm a fan of a lot of those things and some of them not so much.
Now, some films were just sort of warmly received when they were first released, but then got a huge cult on home video. Mm-hmm. Stuff like A Goofy Movie and Hocus Pocus.
Yeah, these things did okay.
Yeah, they weren't juggernauts when they opened in theaters, but over the... People bought them on VHS, and that's what made them.
And they kept re-airing them on the Disney Channel, and they became hugely famous. So for this week on the critically acclaimed Streaming Club, as with all weeks, we pick a streaming service, and we pick each pick two films that we haven't seen before from that service in a certain category to explore what's on there that's older. And this time, we decided we were going to focus on films on Disney Plus that were considered notorious misfires, usually box office duds.
Or at the very least, were critically panned when they came out.
And the winner, and I was surprised and pleasantly so, because this is a film that Whitney has never seen, and I'm actually a bit of a fan of. The winner was a 1979, greatly ambitious sci-fi horror film called The Black Hole.
There is an inexorable force in the cosmos where time and space converge. A place beyond man's vision, but not his reach. It is the most mysterious and awesome point in the universe, where the here and now may be forever.
On my ship, you ask.
It is unavoidable. Moving through space, swallowing everything in its path, radio waves, light.
Are you programmed to speak?
Even planets and stars.
Whitney.
Yes.
Tell us what you knew about The Black Hole before you watched it.
The Black Hole, like all of Disney's more ambitious projects, had a gigantic marketing blitz when it first came out. And even though I was born the year before this film was released, even when I was a young kid, all of that ancillary merch was still hanging out in stores for years.
Yeah, because nobody bought it.
Nobody bought it. Nobody cared.
So you can still find it everywhere.
So I'm still going into kids' bookstores and finding tie-in read-along books for The Black Hole. And I remember.
Hell, I was born in '82, and even I remember that shit still being around.
Yeah. To this day, in a landfill somewhere.
There's a whole lot of Vincent toys.
Yeah, you know, Hunchback of Notre Dame Beanie Babies on a shelf somewhere because they were never bought. The Black Hole was example A of this. So I remember hearing a lot about it. However, I never actually watched it. I think they put it on TV every once in a while, yeah. So I saw like a scene here and there on television when I was a kid, but I never actually sat down to watch it until this podcast. And it wasn't until then that I started looking into, oh, and also that it, what I had also heard about it was that it broke the bank at Disney. It was one of their hugely expensive, really ambitious films
that made
no money back. Yeah. I think it was the most expensive film that Disney had made to date.
Yeah. And it had also a budget of $20 million, which
in 1979, which is pretty big.
Which I think is, that's a staggering amount of money in 1979. Movies just didn't usually cost that much. In fact, I want to check something 1 second.
Adjusting for inflation there.
No, actually, I want to check a comparable film. The budget for Star Wars 2 years earlier was $11 million. Like, the Black Hole cost twice as much as Star Wars.
Cost more than Star Wars.
Yeah. They threw money at this.
And even though the film was in pre-production long before Star Wars was ever a thing, you could see it as a reaction to Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And indeed, a lot of the elements in the Black Hole seem straight stolen from Star Wars.
I this movie actually started off as an adjunct to another wave of successful blockbusters. Before we had a million Star Wars imitators, and Star Wars kind of changed what people were expecting from a box office blockbuster. In the 1970s, the big money box office blockbusters, there were a few different waves, and you know, there was a series of Killer Shark ripoffs after Jaws, the Killer Animal movies, that kind of deal.
Every possession film after The Exorcist. Yeah.
And Planet of the Apes was still going strong for a big chunk of the decade, but the big genre in blockbusters in the 70s, disaster films.
Yeah.
Like, disaster films were big money.
Airport, earthquake, and everything in between.
The Towering Inferno, the Poseidon Adventure. These weren't just, these were big epic movies where they would like build giant sets and destroy them spectacularly on screen. But they also,
they had huge casts of big celebrities.
Yeah, major, so you can get these gigantic celebrity casts. Like, just make your eyes pop at how gigantic all the stars of this, because they weren't needed on set every day. So you could get Fred Astaire for a week and he'd be in the whole movie. And then he would also, you know, there'd just be a million different people in it. So these are big giant draws. And the idea of the Black Hole initially was, let's do a gigantic disaster movie in space, which really wasn't being done. No. That wasn't a common setup.
We've had plenty of space disaster movies in the interim.
Sure.
In fact, Gravity was up for Best Picture in 2012.
Yeah,
That's a space that, in its core, is a space disaster movie.
Oh, 1,000,000%. Yeah. That's exactly what that movie is. The Black Hole was originally positioned as that. And you can tell that, like, in the 2 years between when Star Wars came out and when the Black Hole was finally released, I feel like they probably repositioned some elements to evoke some more Star Wars. There's maybe a little bit more focus on the cutesy robots. There's a little bit more focus on, there's John Barry did the score for the Black Hole. And I want to say this right now, because I don't really know how you feel about the movie, but I have mixed feelings about this movie. I mostly like this movie. John Barry's score for this movie is amazing.
Yeah.
John Barry's score is this sweeping, horrifying, that's full of gigantic swells and like really frightening decrescendos. It's gorgeous.
And it's the kind of film score that was made popular by Star Wars and by John Williams in particular.
Yeah, these big epic sweeping numbers. Yeah. But what I do remember thinking that this time I was watching it was, most of the movie, his score is this like big, gigantic, epic horror movie kind of score, full of threat.
Yeah.
And then there's one scene about 2/3 of the way through the movie, and it's really only one scene, where there's a robot shootout, and then all of a sudden it gets really Star Wars heroic, and I'm just like, that is totally different from the rest of the score. That feels like a note. I don't know if that's true, but it feels like a studio note that said, make this a bit more Star Wars-y and heroic. It's hilarious to me.
The film is, you can see the money on the screen.
Oh, yeah.
This has really spectacular special effects.
They hold up pretty good today, actually. Yeah, they
still look really cool. I like a lot of the interior design. It was up for Academy Awards for its special effects and for its production design.
Cinematography.
Or cinematography.
Visual effects and cinematography. Yeah, it should have been production design.
It was nominated for two Academy Awards in 1979. I don't think it won just because it's, frankly, it's kind of weak tea in terms of the script. They do have a pretty good cast of recognizable actors. Anthony Perkins is sort of the starship captain. Also on his starship are...
Rob Forster's the captain.
Oh, Rob Forster's the captain?
I think Rob Forster's
the captain. I thought he was the first officer. Okay, well.
I think... Well, let me... That's worth checking.
Yeah, Rob Forster, Anthony Perkins, Ernest Borgnine.
Anthony Perkins is a senior science officer. He's Spock.
Okay.
Basically. So Rob Forster is Kirk. He's technically in command. But Anthony Perkins is Spock. He has a lot of weight. Pulls a lot of weight on it.
But we also had Ernest Borgnine, and we also had Maximilian Schell as the bad guy.
Yeah, Dr. Hans Reinhardt.
Hans Reinhardt, it's... Unfortunately, when we see Hans Reinhardt, you realize, oh, you're ripping off Forbidden Planet. And this story is just... As much as they're trying to imitate the tropes of the 70s disaster movies, or a lot of elements from Star Wars, what they're really knocking off is Forbidden Planet.
And Forbidden Planet is part of this mad scientist tradition as well that goes back to stuff like The Island of Dr. Moreau, or even 20,000 Leagues from Under the Sea.
But being set on a spaceship and the way he looks and the way he talks, it feels very specifically like Forbidden Planet. Now, Forbidden Planet's a great movie.
Yeah.
You could do worse than rip it off.
We did a whole episode of Episode Zero about Forbidden Planet. I love it to this day.
Call me heretical if you must, but I'd love to see a modern-day remake of Forbidden Planet.
Sure, why not?
It is just the Tempest story, after all.
I think it'd be neat, honestly. Yeah. I think if you get a director with some vision to it, you know, not just someone who's just going to throw it on screen and be familiar, but someone who can do something kind of interesting.
Luca Guadagnino could do a science fiction film.
That'd be great. Yeah. Ooh.
I'd love to see Luca Guadagnino remake Forbidden Planet.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Because I really like that Suspiria remake he did.
Yeah, he's good. He did something different and distinctive while still being true to the center of the thing. And yes, please. Yes, thank you. That'd be amazing.
But the plot is...
I was going to say Julie Taymor.
Julie Taymor, this like...
Yeah.
Oh, God, she just the weird, the wild, completely nonsensical science fiction movie.
Wouldn't it be great?
We're going to go into a spaceship, but it looks like the ancient Greek Odeons of yore.
We're already off in the weeds. We should give people, if you've never seen The Black Hole, it is on Disney Plus, but here's the basic plot.
Right.
There is a spaceship called the USS Palomino, and it is off amongst the stars doing adventures, and they encounter on their travels...
Well, they're specifically looking for planets to inhabit.
Yeah, they're looking for intelligent life and planets to inhabit. They're Star Trek stuff. They encounter on their travels the what they think is the wreckage of a gigantic spaceship called the USS Cygnus, which is supposed to have been lost 20 years ago, and it was being captained by Hans Reinhardt. And
Cygnus, are you familiar with Cygnus the Swan, the constellation?
No. Oh, isn't it like the first black hole or something we ever discovered?
Well, no, it's just a constellation in the sky, Cygnus the Swan. If you look at it in the sky, it's sort of cross-shaped.
Ah.
If you look at the event horizon from the movie Event Horizon, it's kind of cross-shaped.
Yeah. Oh, Event Horizon, they saw the black hole.
Yeah.
The Event Horizon is clearly made by some people who saw the black hole and really liked it a lot. Like, we'll talk about it. You'll see some parallels.
The makers, the writers and makers of the film Event Horizon clearly like this movie a lot.
And I don't blame them because I like a lot of this movie. So, Maximilian Schell is the last surviving crew member of the USS Cygnus. It's enormous, and it looks like... It's all weirdly corrugated. It looks like all of the surfaces are like the Eiffel Tower.
I was like going to say they look like it looks like a convention hall.
Yeah,
like a convention hall in space. There's a lot of windows and corrugated lattice work.
It's all completely dark and like it looks completely lifeless. Mm-hmm. And then there's this sequence where they're docking with this ship in order to sort of investigate it. And then all of a sudden the entire ship lights up and the sense of scale you get from it is really incredible.
That's something I miss from modern science fiction movies.
Scale?
I feel like a lot of modern science fiction movies are a little too cool to deal with awe.
Yeah.
We sort of take it as, I think the filmmakers take for granted that the audiences are just going to take the ship in stride. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a ship. Yeah, I know ships. I'm okay. Yeah. I don't need to marvel at that. We need to get about the business of doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's not rarely any moments anymore where we just get to sort of look at a large thing and spend a couple minutes looking at it to appreciate how big it is.
I think people forget just how important the first shot after the opening title scroll, the first shot of Star Wars was. Because you see a ship fly by, and it's a big ship.
Mm.
And you're like, wow, look at that big ship. And then a 20 times bigger ship.
Yeah, like, and it keeps on going, like, it comes in from the top of the screen. That was spoofed rather brilliantly in the movie Spaceballs.
Yeah.
Where we see the front of the ship, and it's moving very, very slowly, and we hear this, like, evil score, and it kind of has crescendos. Yeah. But then the ship keeps going, so the music has to keep starting again.
Yeah.
Like, da-da-da. Da-da-da. And it, like, keeps on going and going and going. It's like a 3-minute shot. It's hilarious.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. But you're right. I think there is a certain sense of wonder that we have lost a bit. I think so much of sci-fi has become about making, you know, the world of, you know, spacefaring adventure feel really lived in. And that was one of the things Star Wars did, actually. It was also on top of, they knew a sense of wonder, but they also wanted to make sure this stuff felt like people used it. And before
it
then,
wasn't all clean and antiseptic.
Yeah, before then, the prevailing attitude about science fiction production design in Hollywood was almost exclusively, look at how pristine everything looks. How clean, how shiny, how new. And Star Wars was like, yeah, this is a dilapidated old junker of a spaceship. But it still looks cool, right? We're still going to enjoy it. But I think the black hole understands scale. I think there are actually very few sci-fi movies like this that understand scale as well as the black hole, if you ask me. And I think the black hole, you get a sense of scope and the enormity of space and spaceships better in the black hole than many other movies.
You get the enormity of the ship. When it comes to the actual enormity of space, this movie doesn't know what the fuck it's talking about.
Well, because there's scientifically bullshit.
I actually... Because I was curious, I actually looked up if Neil deGrasse Tyson had said anything about this movie.
Oh, God.
And of course he did.
Of course he did.
He said that, and he gives this, like, 0 stars in terms of scientific accuracy. He called it one of, like, the least scientifically accurate films ever made because it's about a ship hovering around the event horizon of a black hole. You know, the event horizon, which is the point where it's the gravitational pull is so strong even light can't escape.
Yeah. Admittedly, that's a plot point. That's the plot of the movie, is that how is this possible?
How is this possible? But, you know, it's... Anyway.
I remember I watched The Usual Suspects with my dad when it came out. And my dad, who I got the impression was only half watching it, when it was all over, I asked my dad what he thought. And he was like, I don't buy it because you would never put, like, 6 criminals in a lineup. It's always 1 guy and 5 other guys. And I'm like, Dad, that's the plot of the movie. They know that. Mm. They address that specifically. There's a reason for it. That's what... Really? Like, really? So part of me is like, that's the plot of the movie, is that this shouldn't be possible. Is this possible?
It's possible. We need to investigate how this is possible. A movie can lose you early on, and even if it does something impressive later, it's like, but you didn't have me at the beginning with.
Whatever.
The point is... this ship, the Cygnus, and Dr. Reinhardt, played by Maximilian Schell, has been studying it, and he's been out here so long, it's sort of like an Apocalypse Now scenario, where he's like Colonel Kurtz, and he's kind of at the far end of the river, and he's kind of gone mad a little bit.
Yeah, he's leading this, like, weird cult-like society of killer robots at his disposal.
Yeah, it's like, as the crew died, because he's the only surviving crew member.
Yeah, so now he's just surrounded by robots.
So he's replaced all the crew, so he can operate this gigantic, massive ship. He has had to build all these robots. Out of what? We'll find out.
So
there's all these robots, and there's sort of, their hands are floating around these big panels in the background of every shot.
The set of, like, we're used to seeing, like, the bridge of a starship as, I think Star Trek set the template for it. Every once in a while, you'll see something where it's like, in the newer Battlestar Galactica series, it was more like a submarine. Mm. Like, it wasn't like one giant panel in the front and everyone's sitting in that direction. It's all sort of hovering around desks and stuff like that.
Typically, it's a big round room.
Typically, it's a big round room.
With like a chair in the middle where the captain sits.
In the black hole, it's not like a big round room. It's a fucking amphitheater. Like, it's gigantic. Gigantic, and there are like walls of digital readouts like 20 feet high, and it's not practical, but it's gorgeous. Oh my god. It just makes you feel
gigantic,
so small.
Gigantic window where I can look out and see the black hole in the distance.
Constantly in the background.
And
gorgeous.
The black hole looks a lot like, it looks like the wormhole from Deep Space Nine. It's just this big whirlpool in space.
Yeah. Disney, wanted to use the technology that Star Wars used for sort of computerized motion control miniature effects, where, like, you can make sure that you can follow the shot.
The camera is programmed to move in a certain way. So you're, so it's you not can in the match. Hand. Yeah, it's not in the hand of a camera person, and then you can matte over like a matte painting with a moving shot.
Yeah,
essentially.
Nowadays we can do that much more easily with computers, but at the time, if you wanted to get like an actual in-camera shot and actually have the space for the visual effects and have it be consistent so that you can actually do so easily, it was a gigantic process, and Star Wars innovated this. They couldn't get that from Industrial Light and Magic. It was like too expensive or wasn't available or something. So Disney had to create its own version of it called ACES, which is actually automated camera effect system, which is actually a big fucking deal at Disney. It's like a major achievement at Disney. So a lot of innovation was done on this. So again, just to wrap up the plot. So this crew, which consists of Rob Forster, Anthony Perkins, Yvette Mimieux, Ernest Borgnine, and Joseph Bottoms. They get on the ship, and it turns out, wow, there was someone still alive, and he's like been living all alone, and he's gotten really weirdly eccentric. But Anthony Perkins, a science officer, is utterly fascinated by this guy, because this guy has found a way to, A, orbit a black hole. Shouldn't be possible.
No, but
He thinks he's discovered a way to travel through a black hole.
Hmm.
Which would be, if it is possible, a profound scientific breakthrough of some kind. Yeah. And so Anthony Perkins is deeply in love with this guy. And his relationship between, the relationship between Perkins and Maximilian Schell is actually like, you can tell Maximilian Schell is just like, oh, I missed having a suck up so bad. But the rest of the crew is understandably very suspicious, including the robot, Vincent, who is voiced by Roddy McDowall.
Not credited, Roddy McDowall.
And there's another robot that we'll meet later, which is another, he's an adorable hovering robot with an enormous ego. And we meet another version of him with a southern accent, voiced by, also uncredited, the great character actor Slim Pickens.
Yeah. Your mileage may vary with Vincent.
Yeah.
Vincent is an interesting sort of sci-fi construct. This is something that is ripped right off from Star Wars. Like, it feels like we need to put this in because of Star Wars. In the sort of C-3PO R2-D2 vein, sort of the squat little round robot that floats around, has like big square cartoon eyes and you know, comedic reactions to stuff. I'm not sure how I feel about Vincent, because I like Vincent's voice, and I like Vincent's... Vincent has sort of a vast store of knowledge and can communicate with the human characters.
I like a robot that has ego that knows it's smarter than everybody. That's kind of fun.
He has more personality than any of the people.
Yeah.
Maximilian Schell gets some personality because he's a villain. He gets to gnash around a little bit, but all the other humans are a little bit dull.
Yeah, that's fair.
Vincent at least has some personality, probably mostly because he's voiced by Roddy McDowall, who's just a great actor. But I've also heard that the sight of Vincent puts people off their breakfast right away.
Vincent.
Like, they cannot stand looking at Vincent. They don't like how obvious a knockoff of Star Wars he is.
Here's my thing with Vincent. Mm. I think Vincent would be fine if his eyes didn't look stupid.
If he didn't have those big, round, cartoon eyes.
He's got these big, squarish eyes with little black dots in the middle of them.
He looks like Zax from Benji Zax and the Alien Prince.
He does, and that's not a compliment. Vincent was apparently supposed to have eyes that were going to be like stock market readouts. They were actually going to be like kind of animated.
Okay.
And then apparently it stopped working right at the beginning of production, and they decided, fuck it, we just got to keep moving.
Oh, okay.
So they ended up going with this very flat, unarticulated cartoon eyes. Mm-hmm. And it's a mistake. It's a big mistake. It's the part of the, one part of the movie that doesn't look like, wow. That's one part of the movie that looks cheap.
Yeah.
It looks cheap. It doesn't make Vincent more of an interesting character. Honestly, if they had just given him like a lens, like a photo lens or something in there, it would have been a lot, you know, it would have gone a much, much further distance, I think, in making us accept him, because all we can see is that the eyes aren't moving.
Yeah.
So they just look like they're painted on. It looks ridiculous.
To this day, Hollywood has never been really good at faking metal. They try to make things that are supposed to be made of metal, but it's not practical if you were to actually do it. It would be too expensive, or like it's a costume, an actor couldn't wear it.
Yeah.
So they make this sort of plasticky looking stuff.
And then they try to, usually if they're good, they try to like make the sound effects really a mesh out, a clank or something. So we're willing to accept it. Yeah, yeah.
Even they just recently, as of this recording, they recently released photos from the new Shazam film, Shazam Part 2, and they're wearing that fake metal. Looks like plastic.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be metal. Metal shoulder pads or wristbands or belts, and it all looks like plastic to me.
Yeah, it looks fake.
Yeah, yeah. Loki's helmet looks like plastic, and Vincent looks like I could push it over. Like, it's super, like, I could just kick him and knock him over.
I'm not sure. It looks like he's on a string.
He is.
It looks like he's just floating around on a string.
They did really good special effects at erasing the string.
Yeah.
But you might notice they did a really bad job of erasing the shadow that the string cast. So you can actually see the shadow of the string, like, on Vincent or on other characters if you're looking around.
Yeah.
Little detail I forgot.
Nice. Good catch.
Yeah.
Good catch. But yeah, so Vincent knows that something is up, and there's this weird bit where, like, the crew is going to have dinner, with Maximilian Schell, and he's going to talk about his plans, and they don't seem that wicked to him, and Vincent is told to hang out with the other robots, and, it's here that it gets kind of weird, and I actually don't like the tone that they strike, where Vincent considers himself superior to other robots, and it takes this weirdly classist tone where, like, it's like, oh, I don't belong with the downstairs robots. And he just comes across like more of an asshole.
I'm willing to forgive it when it's robots. This has always been really hilarious to me that on the show Futurama, which is a science fiction show with a robot main character, they were able to get away with so much more in terms of, like, rough humor and cruel behavior because the character was a robot.
Yeah.
The human character that couldn't get away with, like, he smokes and drinks and mistreats children and holds people at gunpoint and all that stuff's okay because he's a robot.
Right.
Same thing, and I find myself giving that same kind of leeway. If it's a little plastic ball shooting animated lasers at floating colored dots...
Yeah.
And it's getting high and mighty over, like, faceless robots that have no personality or voice of their own. Yeah. I'm okay with that.
I guess
we're extrapolating off of human behavior.
Well, that's my point, actually, is that we're looking at... And I guess it's not such a big deal because this isn't supposed to be utopian society. It's a horror movie, but, you know, we programmed him to be that way. It's just, like, it puts me off a little bit. Makes me like him a little less, but that's fine.
I've always been a little baffled by the idea that C-3PO has been programmed to be afraid of everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's for diplomacy. He's supposed to, like, he's not supposed to be confident and make big swings. He's supposed to, like, tell him what to do.
Well, but if you're a diplomat, you should be confident, right?
But he's not a diplomat. He's just translating. Okay. And his whole thing is to placate. That's his whole thing. He's to placate.
Oh, yeah.
And the only person he talks shit to is R2-D2.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Anyway. So
there's this long sequence where the robots of Vincent, his new buddy, who is an earlier version of him, so it has the same little red eyes.
Named Bob, and these are all acronyms for things that they made up so they could be called Vincent and Bob.
They are asked to hang out in the robots' lounge, and all the other robots on the ship, first of all, there's one, like, really evil-looking guard robot called Maximilian. I like the design on Maximilian. I think
that's
kind of
a scary looking robot.
Kind of cool looking robot. It's
genuinely
big red thing with, like, angry eye plate and these weird sort of mechanical arms that extend in funny ways.
He's got, like, knives for hands and some things they spin around like he's gonna, like, you know,
blend you.
Yeah, it's
like,
really horrifying.
It's like an immersion blender hands.
Like, Dr. Reinhardt, why do you need his hands to be blenders if it's only you here?
Oh, you have no idea how much I love frozen margaritas. But yeah, all the other robots are like combat bots. They're guards, essentially. Why he needs so many sentries in the ship with no people on it, we don't know. I get the impression that there were a lot of these things, and until we learn the truth that he was, kind of cannibalizing those guard robots to make the operations robots. He with the help of his robot friends. But these guard robots who don't have personality, they don't have faces, they are actors in suits, but they're, moving in robotic sorts of ways. I guess have a lot of pride about their ability to sharpshoot. Now, they're robots.
Yeah.
If you want them to be better sharpshooters, build them that way. It's not a matter of practice with a robot, but I'm not privy to the nuances of artificial intelligence. Maybe there is something to that. But one of the main robots, who is a black robot, mm-hmm. all the other ones are red.
I think it's named Captain Star or something like that.
Just Star, S-T-A-R. Yeah. Is the best sharpshooter, and Vincent easily bests him. Even though both Star and Vincent learn to cheat.
Yeah, like Star, like bump it. Like Bob initially played him, and he actually says, like, you know, we're better designed than these robots, Bob. Have you ever played them at this game? And Bob was just like, yeah, I beat him too. What happened? He beat the living hell out of me. See, and all, Bob is a mess.
Yeah, Bob's like all dented and has like wires hanging out. There's pieces missing off
apparently
of him.
Early attempts to make Bob look like he'd been like dented and destroyed weren't quite cutting it. So finally someone in the production took the clay mold they were using to make more Bobs and just hit it with a pipe or a bat or something.
actually
beat the hell out of it so that we got Bob looking like a wreck. And so Vincent manages to destroy it. But basically what it boils down to is that Bob has been on this ship and he's been suffering on this ship at the hands of these other more violent robots. And he knows the secret of the ship. And the secret of the ship is thus. The rest of the crew died and Dr. Reinhardt has been using the corpses and turning them into cyborgs against their will in order to keep running the ship and doing his experiments.
And unfortunately, this was Disney's first film ever to get a PG rating.
Yeah.
Every film up to this point had gotten a G rating. And
even some stuff they had that had some harsh elements to it, it was still G.
And even though this was, because there's like a couple violent deaths in this movie, and it's pretty intense comparatively, that we don't get to see the true horror of what it's like to be, like, resurrected as a slave cyborg, I think takes a lot of edge off of this movie.
Yeah, there's a whole bit where Yvette Mimeo has, this part is completely unexplained and stupid. Yvette Mimeo has a psychic link
to Vincent.
Why does she have a psychic link? We don't know. Is it technology? Is it luck of the draw? Why is she psychically linked to a robot which has no mind? Is it actually psychic? I don't know.
It's one of those things where it's only mentioned in two scenes. Once it's established, like early in the movie.
Yeah.
And then later they bring it up. And I appreciate when they establish something and then call back to it.
Sure.
But that's also a screenwriting patch job.
Yeah.
Where they needed some sort of plot point late in the movie where they needed to find out where they were in this gigantic ship.
Needs to get the information, but no one else is around her who has it. So they had to figure out a way. And I'm like, phone?
They just like put it in her brain. She's psychic. Well, we didn't establish that. Fine, I'll write a scene earlier where she says that she had a psychic link to Vincent, and that'll be enough.
But it's her and Anthony Perkins who is completely convinced Maximilian Schell is the bee's knees. And finally, Vincent says, yeah, that dude's a monster and he killed everybody. He's making cyborg creatures and it's bad. And she takes Anthony Perkins aside and says, hey, Anthony, this guy killed a bunch of people and he made them into cyborg monsters and it's all bad. And Anthony Perkins is like, no. And she's like, yeah. Perkins is like, no. And she's like, yeah.
What we've seen of the robots is they're human shaped. They're in these like cloaks. They look like death, and they have essentially
mirror
like
faces.
Mirrored fencing foil faces, and G.I. Joe Cobra Commander faces.
Yeah,
or they're sort of like chrome. Yeah. And to the big reveal is they whip off one of those masks, and we see just sort of like a cadaver inside. Yeah, a corpse inside.
What an opportunity if that thing had like wires coming out of its eye sockets.
Remember the movie Fortress where they captured one of the guards and they pulled off its mask and its jaw had been ripped open and its face was all distended
cool
and weird and
movie.
Sick. And they said, like, oh no, they wired his brain directly into the mainframe. And that's like a really visceral moment. You need that visceral moment in the black hole.
By the way, Fortress kicks ass if you've never seen Fortress.
Stuart Gordon's film Fortress is very good.
Christopher Lambert and his wife are arrested for having too many kids in an overpopulated future. And they put him in like this really fucked up futuristic jail. And it's awesome.
They like launch things into your intestines. They give you stomach aches if you step out of line, and they can explode them at any time.
Yeah, it's gross and cool. Mm-hmm. I like that movie.
And Jeffrey Combs is in it because it's a Stuart Gordon film.
Of course,
Jeffrey Combs is in it.
Yeah,
but,
they'll find a way.
but we need that moment of the black hole where they pull off the mask and we get to see like like strands of glop, so, like sucked to the mask, and you know, like they're missing their lips or they're swaling in pain. You know, something like
Anthony Perkins' reaction shot is if he had just discovered the mummified corpse of his mother in his basement. And like, he's got this, oh my God, what a horrible...
And it's actually pretty tame from the visual.
I mean, it'd be weird and surreal, and I'm sure I would be affected by it, but in this movie, it's considering everything else is so over the top, it's actually kind of muted. And then Maximilian gets to work, and Maximilian shoves a rotisserie blade at full speed into Anthony Perkins' chest cavity, which we don't see... And there's no blood, but that's what happens. There's no confusing it. It's really violent for a Disney movie.
Maybe it's just the age in which I grew up, but I want to, like, I'm thinking of some things that came out around the same time, like the Indiana Jones films were shortly after this.
Yeah, someone pulling someone's heart out of their rib cage. Yeah, that was 5 years later. But yeah,
4 or 5 years after this. So, my point is, if you're going to have this, like, gallows space horror opera with these expensive special effects... I mean, I know there's no PG-13 rating yet, but you could push it a little bit more if you're already in PG territory. Well,
because, again, we've talked about this. We talked about this on Not on Disney Plus. We talked about this in a couple other places. This was a weird era for Disney as a film studio.
Yeah.
Because the film studio was doing really badly.
For a long time, too.
Yeah. The film studio had just, like, there have been a few hits here and there. Robin Hood made money, but, like, for the most part, Disney's film output was really underperforming, and they were getting most of their money from, like, the amusement parks. So they were trying to do anything they could to stay relevant, because the old-fashioned nostalgia wasn't really putting butts in seats. So they took some big swings, and what's weird about this era is there's, like, 4 or 5 films from the late 70s through early 80s where Disney made horror movies. The Black Hole is a horror movie in space. It's in a Forbidden Planet kind of realm, but we also had The Watcher in the Woods.
And Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Which are both pretty good. I would argue the Black Cauldron is in this vein as well, where they're trying to do something more mature and more ominous.
It's not a very great film, but that skeleton army at the end is pretty badass looking. And there's some, like, good scary images in that movie.
So they were taking these massive chances, but maybe they just didn't go far enough. And then you hear this talk about, like, how, like, yeah, we made Something Wicked This Way Comes and it was fucking terrifying. And Disney said, good. And then they saw it and they were like, oh, we didn't think you meant it. No. Scale that shit way the fuck back and take out all the cool bits. And that happened with Watcher in the Woods, where the movie ended with this reveal of this really horrifying bug-like monster. And then they cut that out.
Yeah, it turned out...
It's not in the movie.
The release after that, it was invisible. It was like something that had possessed another character.
But if you watch the deleted endings for Watcher in the Woods, you see one of the coolest movie monsters I've ever seen. It's a cool monster.
And an ending that was also used in The Black Hole. The shit's hitting the fan, everybody's dying, Maximilian has murdered Anthony Perkins. Maximilian Schell is now saying, oh God... And now there's also a meteor shower. The only way to flee is to go into the black hole.
We skipped my favorite moment, actually, I think, in the movie. Okay. My favorite character moment is there's a bit, he's just killed Anthony Perkins, and the robots are taking Yvette Mimeo away. And Maximilian Schell is like, I'm going to go into the black hole. And then he pulls Yvette Mimeo aside and says, save me from Maximilian. And then she runs away. And I'm like, the fuck does that mean? There's a whole subplot here that is not discussed at all, where he is terrified of this robot. Is this robot actually pulling the strings? We don't really talk about it. And it that moment where you feel like it would be like, God, can you imagine? I'm trying to imagine. It would be like, imagine you're like the X-Men are fighting Magneto. All right. And the Magneto and his Brotherhood of Mutants and everything are just like, you know, they're taking the X-Men hostage. And then, like, Magneto takes Jean Grey aside and says, save me from Toad. He's a maniac. You're like, what's Toad doing? What's going on? But we never talk about it again.
He's not in charge. He's just really threatening. It's been really awful having him around. I can't kick him off the team.
Like, no, it's like he's afraid of Maximilian. Hmm. Like, it's weird. But yeah, then there's this giant meteor shower, which leads to... maybe the single most gorgeous shot in a sci-fi movie I've seen outside of 2001.
The meteors, it's very fantastical, but it's all really wonderful special effects where these gigantic meteors that look like, I mean, they look like big glowing meatballs.
Yeah, big blobs of fire, suns just hitting things.
These big balls of space lava are flying through the space and just barreling through this gigantic ship and leaving big holes. And they're... again, not scientifically accurate, but one of them crashes into one of like the pressurized chambers and starts rolling toward the main characters. And
like the ball in Raiders, which hadn't come out yet.
And the shot, however, was we get to see the meteor crashing through the roof and rolling toward the camera from a far distance. It's just this gigantic thing. And in the foreground...
Yeah, very small in the foreground.
Very small in the foreground. We see the silhouettes against the glowing lava ball. The main character is running across a catwalk.
Yeah.
And they fall on the catwalk, and it's, and as this huge ball is rolling forward, it's really cool.
The first time I saw this movie, I was able to see a screening in a theater.
Oh, wow, okay.
And that shot brought the house down.
It's just so
that
cool.
That shot is astounding any context. It's glorious. So they're running, and they're running away. They're trying to escape. Bob gets destroyed, trying to save them. It's all sad. And then they end up actually going through the black hole. They can't stop it. And that's when the movie just gets weird. Honestly, there's some really cool imagery in it, but like where like Maximilian Schell, I guess, gets sucked into hell, but we're not going to talk about it.
The black hole leads into hell, and then into heaven, and then back out the other side, back in the earthly realm.
We will not talk about this. We will not explain this. We will not set this up for you as though this is some theory about what could happen in black holes. It's just this thing that happens.
But it's postulating that black holes lead into the afterlife.
Right.
So they go physically into the afterlife, and Maximilian and the Cygnus is destroyed in hell. Yeah. But Maximilian Schell, in this really weird, completely bizarre, really disturbing shot.
Uh-huh.
Like, we see his, like, a close-up of his eyes, and he is all surrounded by red light, and then we pull out, and we learn that his body is now encased inside the Maximilian robot.
Yeah, Maximilian Schell now in a Maximilian Schell.
Isn't that cute?
Yeah. Weird.
I thought of that, too.
Weird bit.
And and it's implied that he's able to survive in hell, which is a physical space now in this like other dimensional realm.
And it's kind of poetic. What happened to him is what he did to other people. He's trapped inside a robot.
And whether or not Maximilian sort of assimilated him like a Borg, or that he was able to use him as a suit. Either way, he is now half robot in hell in this like killer robot.
Yeah.
Suit.
And meanwhile, Yvette Mimeo is like flying through these like crystalline mirrors, and it's a gorgeous shot. It looks amazing on a big screen. But like, it doesn't mean anything. You haven't even really had a meaningful... We've had so many conversations about like what is capable, what black holes could be, or what is scientifically possible, but this has not, until the very end of the movie, been a film about faith. Or
the mysteries of the cosmos.
Yeah, or the belief that there is something beyond our souls, that kind of thing. It's like, you didn't really set this up thematically, so it kind of comes out of nowhere, and by the time we figured out where you're going with it, it's over. And that can't help but be dissatisfying.
Yeah.
And that's the thing I think hurts the movie more than anything else, is that the ending is, it's big and epic, but it kind of just doesn't connect to anything.
Yeah.
And that kind of stinks.
They spent a lot on these visual effects, and it's neat to look at.
Yeah.
But I was reminded of The Watcher in the Woods, the original ending of The Watcher in the Woods, which is where the Watcher, which is this mysterious ghostly presence that's been haunting the entire movie and has been taking possession of people's minds and luring kids out into the woods, is actually an alien being that's been abducting people.
Yeah. In the theatrical cut, they don't say that.
In the theatrical cut, it's like this demonic other, like,
maybe
disembodied consciousness that comes from another dimension and is like, has been pulling all the strings, but by possessing human bodies.
In one of the deleted endings, you see it was on a spaceship. Like, it was definitely like a UFO alien.
A missing character had just been on a spaceship this whole time.
Yeah.
And they rescued this person on a spacecraft that is like out in the like distant stars.
There's a lot of movies have been screwed up by like having their ending changed or tacked on, but Watcher in the Woods just became a totally different genre.
Yeah.
Became a different genre. That doesn't usually happen.
And I think the ending we got is like more in keeping with what the movie was, but I like the bonkers science fiction ending.
I think you should have at least kept the monster. We're off track, but like I think you should have at least kept the monster.
The monster was really like,
you don't need to explain that the monster's an alien, but we should look at it because it's cool.
Yeah.
Very rarely is it like we're going to set up this monster, we're not going to see it, and then once you actually see it, it's like, that's better than I thought it would be. That's neat. But yeah, here it's...
All of a sudden, we're, like, flying through hell, and it's, like, the to go back to Event Horizon, that's a big part of the movie. They bring it up frequently, and the ship is in a cross shape. It's supposed to look like Notre Dame Cathedral.
Yeah.
And the idea that it, by going through into another dimension, we kind of accidentally went into hell, and it came out on the other side, like, with demons all inside of it.
Yeah.
Interesting enough idea for a science fiction movie. Sure. I like Event Horizon.
It's been done before and since quite a few times. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
They don't bring up any of that stuff beforehand. It's more like it's more like about this conspiracy about this guy who's been out in space far away from stuff for so long that he's kind of lost his humanity and is now killing people and turning them into helper robots because reasons.
Yeah. The Black Hole is a spectacularly gorgeous production. Like, the somewhat disappointing robots aside, almost everything else in this movie looks stunning. Truly eye-poppingly stunning. Like, what an amazing set this must have been to walk around on.
Yeah.
Like, just some, because some of it's a matte painting, but a lot of it isn't, and it's really cool looking. It's absolutely gorgeous, fantastic sense of scale, and I think that sense of scale, I think that oppressive production design carries a lot of the movie and really elevates what is, and this is the biggest problem, flimsy material. You have a disaster movie, and the reason why a lot of those disaster movies like The Poseidon Adventure and The Towering Inferno were hits wasn't just the scale, but because the characters were written kind of melodramatically. You know, they didn't have a lot of space, so you had to write them kind of big, and as a result, they popped off the screen. They were memorable characters. Here, Maximilian Schell is a memorable character. Vincent's a memorable character. Maximilian is threatening enough as a robot, but he doesn't have a character.
It's just a monster more than a character.
Rob Forster doesn't really have anything to do, does he? Vet Mimeo doesn't have anything to do. They don't stand for anything. They don't believe anything. Ernest Borgnine's completely wasted in this film.
And he's trying, Ernest Borgnine. He's trying to give his character some character, but
but he doesn't need to be there. It's frustrating. And then on top of it all, the thematic material is really unexplored when it could have easily been there. You've got all this dialogue anyway. Bring up something about the infinite or the unknown, for fuck's sake. Bring up something about how before we had science, we thought about religion as a way to explain the universe. Yeah. And then when that happens, it'll connect in our heads and we'll be like, oh yeah, and then we can appreciate it rather than wondering what the fuck. And then after the credits have rolled, we're like, oh, that's what they probably meant.
Yeah. Like, and what happens is they fly out on the other side. And I don't think, is there even a line of dialogue before the credits roll?
I don't think there is.
They just sort of go out on the other side. Yeah, we've seen heaven. We've seen hell. No dialogue, no discussion, credits.
Yeah.
It's like, they're just out.
I kind of wish we hadn't seen them out. Honestly, they should have just ended there.
Just stayed in the black hole.
They all died.
Yeah.
Yeah, fuck it. Like, make it, like, big and epic and sad.
Oh, and there, you know what? If they stayed in the black hole, they died and either, like, went to metaphysical heaven or hell.
Yeah.
Or they just went into a new dimension, which happens to be heaven or hell.
And yet, ironically, here we are left in kind of a limbo, where it's just sort of like...
They came out on the other side and it was actually purgatory.
Yeah, and we're just sort of waiting around being bored.
That would have been a good ending, too. We went through hell, we went through heaven, where are we? Nothing's happened. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
How long do you have to stay here? A long time. Roll credits.
Well, it can't be too bad because it's limbo. Like, it can't be. It's not hell.
Oh, God. Are we going to age here? Yeah, we're going to get older and older. And Vincent's like, what's that?
Oh, God. So that happens when your batteries die, Vince. And Vincent's like, no! So anyway, again, I quite like this movie, flaws and all, because I feel like in the end... What's good about it is so gorgeous that it mostly compensates for some obvious flaws. But what was your ultimate takeaway?
I take away from this movie the same way I take away from a lot of Disney's more spectacular flubs. A lot of really gorgeous visuals. A lot of people who clearly worked very hard on production design. But a lot of bungling in the screenplay phase where people aren't thinking of a better story for these characters and throwing in a lot of things that do and don't fit along the way. There's some inappropriate humor along the way. And the same things could be said about films like The Lone Ranger or John Carter, other notorious Bonds
from they don't know what they're doing, but they want you to like it.
Yeah.
So they'll just throw in anything even if it doesn't fit half the time.
Like The Lone Ranger has like the two train chase where people are leaping back and forth between two
impressive.
Chains.
It goes on too long, but it's really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, it's just wonderfully choreographed, but it's in service of a movie that is bad. It's quite bad. Quite a bad film.
Yeah.
It's just structured badly. The performances are weird. It's humorous. It's not humorous.
Yeah, it's not well thought out thematically either.
There were supernatural things that they cut out at the last minute.
Yeah,
so, like,
you can tell they're missing too. Because that was supposed to be about were-coyotes.
Yeah.
And or Wendigos. I think one or both.
The bad guys were supposed to be supernatural, and then in the final product, they weren't. So they do some things that are really odd for human beings to do. I feel the same way about the black hole. They put a lot of thought and energy into the special effects and into the production design, and those things are great. The design on Vincent notwithstanding. But the actual, at the end of the day, you know, we're talking about these gigantic ships and, you know, living out in the cosmos and what's inside black holes. And we're doing something that William Castle would have done, like a really simple story. I would have loved to have seen a William Castle version of this without all the special effects, because at least it would have had bigger actors and, like, more fun character scenes.
I don't see why it has to be one or the other. I just feel like...
Because William Castle didn't deal with budgets like this.
I think we're just thinking, because this movie was directed... was it by Gary Nelson? Is that what his name was?
Yeah,
Gary Nelson, who's a TV director. And he had done a lot of, like, big TV. He had just done, at the time, an Emmy-nominated TV movie or miniseries called Washington Behind Closed Doors. But he'd also worked on everything. He worked on Gilligan's Island, The Patty Duke Show, Get Smart. His biggest, most successful... Luca's
saying hello.
He just wants to jump up on my lap and say hi. But his biggest movie he'd done before this was Freaky Friday.
That's right.
It was a big hit. For Disney, so I appreciate them wanting, but he doesn't really...
And he would go on to do the Indiana Jones knockoff, Alan Quartermain and the Lost City of Gold.
Oh, yeah, starring Richard Chamberlain and Sharon Stone.
Sharon Stone,
But he doesn't seem to really... apparently, he turned this down, and then he found out, like, how epic the production was going to be, and he got excited by that.
Okay.
And I think you needed someone who was excited by that and wanted to tell a story. Mm. And I don't get the impression that anyone in this film was particularly interested in telling the story of the black hole. Mm. And I think that's the loss here. I think if you had had, you know, a William Castle-like director who got, like, big, broad performances out of people and, like, really got off on, like, you know, these kinds of, like,
villainy.
Yeah, mad scientist. It's a mad scientist story. You got off on a mad scientist story. There's so much you can tell with it. I think you need both. And without both, you only get one, right? Mm-hmm. And if you could only pick one, it's a matter of what would you rather have? Would you rather have a glorious sci-fi spectacle? I mean, it looks like it'd be the coolest... The ending of the movie looks like it'd be the coolest Disneyland ride ever.
They were probably thinking about.
Sure,
at
they
the
were.
Time,
and they clearly would have loved to have done it. Or do you want a cheaper movie with hammier storylines that probably would have worked better? And they made their choice. They did the Disney choice. They were going after something big and epic and that would make them a ton of money, and maybe it was the bad choice in the long run. But in the end, I do like this movie, and I do hope people see it. It's short. It's not like it overstays its welcome. It's like an hour and 35 minutes or something.
It's about a 100-minute film.
So, you know, it's in and out. It doesn't, I think, overstay its welcome too much. And again, especially if you have, like, a decent, like, home setup, you know, like a big TV or a projector or something like that, do yourself a favor and put on The Black Hole someday and just marvel at how cool it looks. And if the movie doesn't do it for you, fine, but I do think you'll at least see something like an impressive spectacle, if nothing else.
To compare this very briefly to a film that they would do a few years later that also had two expensive visual effects, and they tried all these brand new techniques all to create a unique-looking but not necessarily great-looking movie, Tron.
Yeah.
Tron was an immensely expensive movie. Mm-hmm. They were trying to pioneer a lot of, like, really new computer effects, and it looks weirdly cheap for how much money they spent on it. Yeah. I mean, I like the look of Tron.
It's got a cool aesthetic.
But when you figure out, like, all these processes they did to, like, make the glowing effects appear on people and these, like, little glitches appear and how they had to sort of blend characters in with the CGI, you realize that they put way too much work into it for the actual result. And I think the same is true of the black hole.
Well, I've heard them talk about the making of Tron and how, like, you know, because they had to do so much pre-work on the visual effects, it left them almost no wiggle room to adjust the story.
Yeah.
After that. So the story couldn't develop past the early stages because the visual effects were done. And the shot had to look like this and last this long. And so they were kind of trapped. So probably the case here. But in any case, that is it for the critically acclaimed streaming club.
The point I was going to make is that Disneyland has never nailed the formula.
No.
In terms of spectacle. They know how to do it in animation.
Yes.
But they, I don't they feel like they've ever really mastered it in live action, because they know that they need to spend a lot of money, but I feel like they don't really know what to spend all that money on.
Mm-hmm.
So they look at something like Star Wars and say, let's do something like that. And so they try to do Star Wars one bigger, make something that looks great. Mm-hmm. Does it look as good as Star Wars?
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with you on this, and I'm pretty sure if anyone else wants to chime in on this, we would love to hear from you. I think Disney has done spectacle well. I mean, hell, before this, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. It's a wonderfully handsome production.
It's fine.
Yeah. And anything, does a voice from the ether want to contribute?
Disney's done plenty of bread and circuses, okay?
You've gotten
all of it out there. You got Multiplane, you've got the exploitation of brilliant immigrants, genius inventions, just to give you your spectacle. Mm. Accept it and enjoy.
I refuse.
Okay. That was the disembodied voice. We're all disembodied voices here, aren't we? But that was the disembodied voice of M. Lapis da Silva, who, in addition to being a wonderful author, check out her retrowave, pro-queer, feminist, pro-sex work horror novel, Hooker, wherever fine books are sold. But also the incredible maven of Salt Cat Soap, where she has designed many of our wonderful designs over at Salt Cat Soap on Etsy. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Salt Cat Soap. She's also an expert in many, many things. And one of them is she studied a lot of animation. She studied a lot of Disney. Okay. She knows of which she speaks.
I feel about the way Disney uses their special effects. It's like making chicken pot pie from scratch. You can get
it's delicious.
You can make get the finest ingredients. You can mix them all together. You can bake it, and it tastes exactly the same as the one you get out of the box.
So you've had really shitty chicken pot pies.
Oh, that's not a good pie.
No, you made it. You've got some really bad chicken pot pie, dude. I'm sorry. I think that's the problem. But no, I would argue that I think Disney's done the spectacle right at least a few times.
All right.
But
I said in animation. Yeah. I agree.
But I mean live action. I think in live action they've done it a few times. All right. They were at least partly responsible for Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I mean, come on, that's a glorious film. But also, there is something to be said for spectacle for its own sake. And I think, you know, Disney prides itself in doing theme park attractions. I think that's part of it, you know?
Yeah.
Come in, like, there's not necessarily a lot of depth in all of the Disney rides. Some of them there is. But sometimes it's just, ooh. And I think that can be the black hole as well. Michelle? Thoughts? I can see Michelle. She's behind Whitney and be like,
she's sitting behind me, and I can feel daggers in my neck here. But yeah.
I mean, I don't know. This is a lot of thoughts, but Disney theming attraction, a lot of it is about taking you as close to the experience of death and getting you out alive in a fun way.
Mm. Yeah.
I think that the black hole is one of those actual. It's the attempt to create sort of as close to a themed attraction in the theater as you can get, which is why they use the, I think, whatever CinemaScope they did at the time, framing the lenses. This is all related to their other projects that they were doing that were live action theme things where you would have like the Journey to Mars and stuff, liftoffs and things like that. It's all sort of spectacularly tied in together.
Okay. This is of a piece with theme park attractions.
Yeah, this is an experience.
It's an extension of the creative imagination of Imagineers.
Okay.
So they are the ones who did the park stuff. So it's one and the same creative mind.
Yeah, and that doesn't necessarily make it a good movie, but it is definitely a lens through which to experience the film, which maybe can make it more enjoyable.
All right. Maybe I'm not reacting to the film as passionately because I hate Disneyland.
Well, there you go. What can we do with that, right?
You're putting in a lot of work and imagination to something I hate. So,
well, there you go. we can't really fight with that. All right. Well, listen, that is that for the Streaming Club. Right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. You're all really cool. We'll be back next time. And next time, we're going to be focusing on the Criterion Channel.
That's right.
All of our options at the Patreon poll this week are for the Criterion Channel, and we've decided for Pride Month, we're going to be looking at queer films on the Criterion Channel, and the nominees are Sylvia Scarlett from the 1930s, starring the amazing Katharine Hepburn, Female Trouble, directed by John Waters, Paris is Burning, which is another disaster film about that time Paris burned.
No, it's a documentary.
It's a documentary. And a film I'm actually not familiar with, Corel, which I believe is a Fassbender film.
Yeah, Rainer Werner Fassbender film. It was his last movie, too.
Okay, amazing. So we'll have a bit more detailed descriptions about those on our Patreon page. If you want to vote, even for $1 a month, you get to vote for our polls. And it's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We would love to hear from you. We would love to let you to help us decide what we're going to watch every single week. Here at the Streaming Club, we also have a lot of exclusive shows about Star Trek, Batman, commentary tracks, the Academy Awards, not on Disney Plus, as we discussed here a lot today. All of that's available there. You're also more than welcome to follow us on Twitter, at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
You can also email us, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net is our email address.
We have a P.O. Box, Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064. We got a postcard.
Nice.
Somebody mailed us a postcard. It was a 101 Dalmatians postcard from one of our listeners, and it just said, here's a postcard. It's better than a bill.
It sure is. And
if you send us a letter, that counts as a letter for our letters episode, so we could read that on the episode.
If you want more of M. Lapis Da Silva, you can follow her on Twitter at _M. Lapis Da Silva. I'll make sure we tag her when this episode goes live, because she ended up being a vital component of the conversation.
Weird!
And also, don't forget to check out her soaps. Go to Etsy and look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. You can also follow Salt Cat Soap on Twitter and Instagram at Salt Cat Soap. Look for the beautiful illustration of Luca, illustrated by M. Lapis Da Silva. And there's some we're having a sale through the end of the month on some of our more exclusive items. But we also have a lot of gorgeous handcrafted soaps, mostly crafted by Michelle. We will see you next time on the Streaming Club, reviewing one of those films. One of those films we talked about today.
Yes.
On the Streaming Club. And that's how the podcast ends.